session. We want to make sure we give Pastor Brian as much time as we possibly can. My name is Phil. I've been asked to kind of introduce what we're doing here today. So just a little bit about Pastor Brian. He's going to give he's going to talk a lot about what they're doing at Dream Center. So Brian Sederwall has over 20 years of ministry in Florida, California, and Colorado. He and his wife and three boys launched the Denver Dream Center in 2014 to rescue, rebuild, and restore lives in Denver. In 2018, the Denver Dream Center mobilized over 7,000 volunteers to serve over 30,000 people in the city of Denver. In December alone, the DDC took care of 10,000 kids for the holidays, giving away over $350,000 in resources and services to the city of Denver. Through strategically serving in Denver, God has given Pastor B significant relationships with the mayor, police chief, chief safety director, director of parks and rec, Denver Housing Authority, Denver Nuggets, Denver Broncos, Colorado Rockies. Can I say go Avs? And so many more. His passion and prayer is to create impact and have influence for Jesus in the city of Denver. Guys, could you welcome with me Pastor B?
Thanks for showing up. Normally, I'm the guy that an 11 o'clock session, I sneak out for lunch early. So we didn't know if anybody would actually stay, but I'm glad that you did, because we love any opportunity we have to sort of share our story, what God's doing in and through the Denver Dream Center. If I can, I'll just start for a few minutes on my background and how God's brought me to do what we do now. One of the things I love to challenge and tell people, especially pastors and leaders, I mean, I'm a church kid. So I grew up in Illinois. I actually grew up on the Assembly of God campground, so my life was nothing but summer camps all year long. My best friend is now a pastor of a large church in San Diego. His dad, Gary Grogan, was our, at that point, I think it was still called a DCAP. Anybody remember DCAP days? He was our DCAP, and then, you know, then we got the DYDs. And so that was my life growing up. My parents both went to Evangel University. Graduated in 1968, moved to Illinois, and became public teachers. And so growing up on the campground, my life was a real unique blend of church, old school history and heritage. Our church, the Assembly of God campgrounds in Illinois. Anybody ever been there, Lake Williamson? Yeah, right? Awesome place. I grew up literally on the lake. So my life, if you've never been there, it's an amazing, amazing place. That from when my parents moved there in the 60s, it was just getting started, to by the time I was growing up there, camps that were running, you know, over 1,000 kids, and just an incredible complex. And there were a lot of retired pastors and missionaries. So a lot of my story growing up was being around pastors and missionaries that had, you know, gone overseas in the 40s and 50s, and now in their 80s had retired and lived there. And so I cut my teeth, right, kneeling at the altar every Sunday night, and had missionaries, and our goal as once we got to youth group was you couldn't be the first person to leave. So I remember, like, you know, I'd be done praying for a long time. My ADD would kick in, but, like, you know, I would still be, like, leaning over, waiting for, like, don't be the first person to move, don't make your spirits enough. And, but those great moments. And then really felt, when I was 12, I was at summer camp, AG summer camp. And I remember directly walking out. I can't tell you who the speaker was, can't tell you what the message was about, but at age 12, I could tell you that I wanted to be a pastor. And that's what I spent my life chasing. So I don't have a crazy story. I didn't have that call to ministry at 12 and then run off and get wild and do my own thing and God bring me back. I've never been incarcerated. I've never been addicted. Matter of fact, I've never even been drunk. So I don't have this crazy story of, like, here's what God brought me from. A lot of my story, what I'll tell people, is I had amazing parents that prayed and poured into me and lived a life that ultimately I can look back and I'm still thankful, right, to not have crazy regrets that God had to bring me through, but that God prepared me for. And so all of that, and then ended up going to Central Bible College when it was still around. Now it's really complicated because people are like, where'd you go to school? I'm like, well, sort of. It's, and they sold it like a couple months ago, so now it's like literally gone. So now I just tell people I went to Evangel, which is sort of true, because when I was at CBC, I actually had an Evangel ID card, and so I spent most of my time at Evangel while I was going to of CBC. My brother was there, and so I'm a byproduct of that. And I'm a byproduct of the Assemblies of God. Great parents, a great church, great youth ministry. My first job was in West Palm Beach, Florida. I like to say it was God called me there, but I think it was living on the ocean on the beach. And I spent a couple years there, and then went to L.A. And so we spent 8 years in Los Angeles. And it was during that time in L.A. that God really began to open up. For me, my heart is that of an evangelist. I love being in the nitty-gritty, the dirty, on the streets, on the basketball court, somewhere that is outside of Sunday morning context. And so I started spending so much of my time when we were in L.A. We got connected with the Barnetts when they were getting the L.A. Dream Center. Anybody been to the L.A. Dream Center? Some of you have. So 18, 19 years ago, they're about 5 years old, we started going down and plugging in and absolutely loved what we saw God doing in communities through their Adopt-A-Block, how they were generating interest and influence outside of just what they did on a Thursday or Sunday. Started plugging in with that, loving what they were doing. We started a nonprofit in the city that we were at, and we built a rec center. I'm a sports fanatic, and so we built a basketball facility. And I remember the second week I came to open it up, it looked like a scene from a movie. There were hoopties and cars, and I'm the only white guy walking up to the gym. Music's bumping. I'm like, Jesus, we didn't have outside lights on yet. So I'm like, just get me inside the gym. Let me get this door open. And just by God's grace and favor, we started playing basketball and building relationships. My house, I tell people, looked like a gang house, crack house half the time. It was always a barbecue, guys hanging out, watching games, and just building relationships. I started spending an absorbent amount of time in the barber shops. And if you've never been in the hood into a barber shop, it's a cultural experience. And I would just spend time building relationships. I started going to court with guys that were getting arrested, started figuring out what they were walking through. And it made me realize a lot of them aren't ready for like a Sunday morning church invite because they're just trying to figure out how to survive. They need to pay rent. They lost their kids. There's, you know, an addiction. There's a gang shooting. There's something going on. And God placed me, crazy enough, in the middle of all of that. We started running these midnight basketball leagues where we would run from 10 o'clock at night to about 4 o'clock in the morning. And it wasn't bring your team as a rec league. It was you had to actually sign up, and then we did a selection, like a draft. So these guys had to fill out an application. We would get the life skill piece involved, and then we would actually have coaches that would select. And so it was like an NBA draft night. So all these gang members would come, and they would wait to see like where they were selected, what team they were placed on, and then that began again to just open relationships. And so for me, it really started this process of how much life there is outside of Sunday morning church, if I'm being honest. Yeah. I was spending so much time waking up on Monday, right, sitting in staff meetings, and how many of us have been there where you're already thinking the next sermon series, the next worship set, do we have enough kids workers? And it's recovery from what happened on Sunday to prepare for the next, right? Every Sunday feels like it comes like every 3 days. Right. And I kept hitting that, like I felt like I was hitting the repeat button. And I'm missing like what was outside of here. And the more that I started connecting in our community there, and the more I started seeing what the LA Dream Center was doing, it just opened my eyes. And so when we moved to Denver, my wife and I, we've got three boys that are now 15, 12, and 9. So if you've raised kids, you know how crazy that world is. And raising three boys, a high schooler, a middle schooler, and an elementary schooler right now. And my boys are sports fanatics, so we're in baseball, basketball, football, like all year round, every day, it seems 24/7. My boys, their names are Noah, Jake, and Jonah. But we call them No Stop and Don't. Literally, it's like you wake up. And that's my wife. Like, her poor world, like, she only knows, like, girls. So raising boys has been a new adventure for her. And so that's our world. So when we got to Denver, the journey was sort of interesting. My cousin and her husband started Red Rocks Church. I'm sure most of you heard of. And so we came out when Red Rocks was maybe 100 people. And we thought it would be an opportunity to launch a downtown campus, but downtown Denver is far different than Golden. Yeah. And bringing CCU students to a church and building that culture versus we started on the 16th Street Mall. So if you've been to Denver, and 12 years ago, it was filled with a lot more homeless and a lot more issues. And so our Sunday morning wake-up experience to go set up in the movie theater on the 16th Street Mall, we would go in, and while we're setting up New Genesis Homeless Shelter, it's just a few blocks away off of 17th and Sherman Street in Denver. they kicked the guys out at 6 o'clock in the morning. So here we are trying to set up, and they heard that we had donuts and coffee. And so the balance is, you want to love on the homeless, right? But when they're coming just for donuts and coffee, and you tell them, hey, you can't come in right now because we're setting up, and then they get mad, and then they start, you know, peeing on the doorstep, and cops are coming, and we're like, guys are pulling guns and knives, and we're trying to like just set up for church. We actually had a team that their job as volunteers, they had to go through all of the different movie theaters because we'd have the homeless come in, and they would just disperse. And they would just find a place that they could sleep and hang out. We had a separate bathroom that was like the dry shower. Like, we got to spray you down with some body spray. In here, brush your teeth real quick. We love you, but you smell. And just creating those moments. So years into it, we realized, again, church planting really wasn't our calling. It was figuring out, how do we serve our city? And so setting the base to be able to share with you today that here's what we've learned. And I'm gonna give you like hopefully some words that you can take with you. I didn't print stuff out. I know you can take notes to remember, or if not, please grab our card, email me. If you ever want us to come share or train or teach or do something with you or your church, we love that. Because again, I feel like God's taking me through the journey of leading a church, but knowing there's a greater impact and influence we can have. We just gotta figure that out. And so what we've learned is when we transitioned May 16th, so just a few weeks from now, will be our 5-year anniversary as the Denver Dream Center. So on paper, we're 5 years old. In the journey, we're 12 years old. Because it took me about 7 years of working 2 part-time jobs and just doing ministry in the city, hanging out in the housing projects, hanging out in the correctional facilities, finding where things were at. And so here's the first 2 words that I would give you if you're trying to figure out how like you impact and serve your community better. The first 2 words are cause and concern. And I think we're really good oftentimes at establishing what our cause is, right? We have local outreach, or we have missions, or we're feeding the homeless. And we can identify causes. And we live in a generation or world right now where we're very cause-oriented. Most companies now have some kind of 10% kickback to support, you know, wells in Africa, or saving the fish, or no more plastic straws. It's all paper straws, which I get, but I hate, because like 2 minutes into your paper straws, they're like melting in your mouth. And so everybody's got a cause, right? Causes are easy to find, but if you really ask people, like, but why do you have that? Like, what's your concern? And that's where it took a while for us to identify, coming from L.A. to Denver, completely different cities. Now, there's similarities in maybe what some of those areas are that we want to address. But overall, we had to figure out, like, what's the concerns of Denver? What's the issues? Before we go out, right, we know the greatest cause is preaching the gospel. We want people to come to Christ. That's transformational. But the nuts and bolts of that, what does that look like? If we just do missions or local outreach or serve our community like we've always done because we have a cause, but someone asks you, well, like, what's the concern? And you don't know really what the numbers are, I think that puts us in a bad place. Because here's what I began to see. When I started spending years, and again, I tell people all the time, I'm super antsy, I'm very impatient, I don't sleep much, and I drink a lot of coffee. So I get in this mode of like, I want things done quick. Anybody with me? Right? It's hard. Like, my mom was the queen of like, wait. Right? And as a kid, you know, my kids do that now. They come up like, dad. And if you tell them, like, hold on a minute. Like, right? That, like, for some of us, that drives us crazy. And that was me. I don't want to wait. I want to know now. I want it fixed by yesterday. And I want to, right? It's quick solutions. It's when I, you know, making my coffee, I get mad at my Keurig, like, because it takes so long to warm up. Right? I'm like, second, like, coffee now. And we're instant gratification with stuff quick. And so as we began to look at the city and the issue that we are facing, what I began to realize is going in and meeting with Denver Housing Authority. I didn't know a lot about how DHA operated and the logistics of every program and staffing and what they had. But there was a neighborhood that almost 8 years ago now, it's one of our poorest communities in Denver, it's close to Bronco Stadium. I went in and I saw there was some junior high and high school basketball, our boys playing basketball on an outdoor court. And I've always got like my gear in my car, so I just stepped out, started playing basketball, found out the next day one of those 15-year-old boys was shot and killed. In a gang retaliation. And so for me, that gripped me. Like, that might have been the last moment that this 15-year-old high school kid had a chance to hear about Jesus, or that there's hope, that there is something that can happen for him. And so that for me, that gripped me. That became a concern. And in that neighborhood, I wanted to know what programs existed, and were there any local ministries, and what's the issues that Denver Housing's, you know, working with and working through. And so within a matter of days, I showed back up and went into their resource center where their offices are at, just introduced myself. And they gave me sort of the blank stare, like, that's great, and good luck, and that was it. But I kept showing up, and I kept coming back, and I kept asking, like, what do you need? How can we help? What do you need? How can we help? I didn't come in, said, I've got answers, and you guys aren't doing it well, and let me fix it for you. I just kept asking, like, what do you need? How can I help? And after a certain period of time, they realized, one, I wasn't going away, and that we literally just wanted help. There was no catch. There was nothing in it for us. We weren't asking for budgets. We weren't asking for their resources. We just wanted to help. So we sat down, and it took a course of about 6 months to a year. I met with their legal department. I met with their staff. We drafted this 20-page MOU, a memo of understanding, and they signed it with their lawyers and with our documents. So now, if you go to Denver, as the Dream Center, as a faith-based organization, we have access to every Denver Housing facility and complex. Meaning, like, when we do our adopt-a-blocks on Saturday, I'll talk about that in a minute, we go in and serve, and we wanted to be consistent. And if you don't have a building, right, coming from Southern California, it rains like once a year, and maybe twice a year dips below 65 degrees. Like, you can be outside and be consistent, but in Denver, come on, right? Like, it snowed last week. You know, these cyclobombs keep coming. Who knows what's going to happen? And so we wanted to be consistent, though. We wanted to be able to go in, and we're in neighborhoods that are filled with broken promises, broken trust. We didn't want to offer a service or a program and say, I'm sorry, we can't make it because the weather's bad, or we can't facilitate this. But it took years of, again, identifying what the concerns were to establish our cause. So what I began to see within our city, when I met Denver Housing, our police chief is one of my closest friends in the city of Denver now. And meeting with him, he was our police commander of District 1 for a number of years. We began to just serve and get to know him, taking him coffee, again, just being present, becoming a friend, becoming a trusted partner. But the more I spent time with our mayor, with our police chief, our city safety director, anybody that was in a place of influence in our city, here's what I began to find out. And this is Denver specific. That as we would wake up on Monday as pastors thinking about our next sermon series and our worship sets and our next, you know, round of programs and things that we're working on and planning 3, 6, 12 months out, the city wakes up on Monday and they're thinking about affordable housing. They're thinking about violent crimes. They're thinking about homelessness, right? We've got an election coming up with our mayor. We've got a proposition about public camping and camping bans. Anybody tracking that at all with this? It's called this right to exist, or this right to live. And on one side, it's trying to humanize homeless, that everybody should have the ability to be able to live and be anywhere they want on public access to property within the city. But business owners and people that are struggling to, like, keep their operations going, all right, they're not wanting to dehumanize that. They're wanting to protect their business. And so there's this clash of interest of what to do with homelessness. We've now got almost per capita some of the cheapest heroin in the country is in Civic Center Park in downtown Denver. You may have saw that on the docket recently, our city council actually passed the proposal to have a safe injection site. Anybody see that?
Yeah.
We're talking issues that for a lot of us, we wake up, right, and we're thinking sermon series and volunteers and coordinate, and that's important. Don't get me wrong. I'm not downplaying that at all. I'm a fanatic and believe that the local church is the hope of our communities. But we can't be disconnected from what our communities are facing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so if we're going to do local outreach, if we're going to serve our communities well, before you establish a cause, you've got to identify the concern. And I was humbled as I began sitting in these meetings realizing, like, I'm really pretty clueless on what they're dealing with on affordable housing. The hot pockets of homelessness in our city and the lack of either solutions or service providers. One of the things that I was guilty of that I began to see, if you've been in Denver, the Rescue Mission, right, the famous building that has the Jesus Saves on the side, super popular. And they are an amazing organization. They've got about 400 beds that they provide nightly for those that are on the streets. But the problem is it's a very condensed area with homelessness, which means there's a lot of drugs, there's a lot of violent crimes, and it spills into that area that now the city calls the ballpark community, that they're sort of making, like, they've got this big plan to make it like Wrigleyville. So it's all these lost restaurants and businesses, but yet right in the middle, you got hundreds of homeless. So if you want to take your family to a baseball game and it's a night game, and you park six blocks the wrong direction, you're like, kids, stay close, right? And you're trying to get to a family event at a baseball game, but yet the homeless are there panhandling. Again, there's so many issues. And so what I didn't even realize is when I was a youth pastor, right, the thing that we would do was like, hey, let's go feed the homeless. We need to do an outreach and service project. So we would make bag lunches. We would grab together. We would show up near Triangle Park or the Rescue Mission, and we would hand out bags, and we would pray with people. And then we'd take a lot of pictures, and we would leave, and we would like, I got to pray with 24 homeless people today, and we fed 100 people. Like, all those things are great. But what I didn't realize when I started meeting with the city, for a while I was on a commission with our mayor, and he would say that for every $5 handout we would do, it would cost the city $1,500 to clean up the mess. Because when we would leave from doing this great cause with good intentions, right? We're going to help people, but we leave, and guess where every bag and baggie went? On the streets. Every person that was supposed to be in line for a service that the city's providing is now shortcutted because now they don't need to wait in line because someone just gave them a resource. Like it or love it, agree with it or not, there's a camping ban in Denver. It's illegal to pitch a tent and camp in public spaces. Again, I'm not debating whether that's right or wrong. That's just the law. But we have good-hearted people that see homeless people that are cold. So you know what they do? They show up, and they hand out tents, and they hand out sleeping bags. So now I'm meeting with the police department, and they're struggling because how do they enforce the letter of the law when technically it's illegal? And what they've had to walk through is they're trying to break down maybe a homeless camp that's illegal to have pitched up. But every homeless person has a free phone. Right, and so all of a sudden, here's a police officer that for like 30 minutes has been trying to calmly assist somebody in moving to the right spot. And in the last minute, they have to help them pull the tent down so people flop off their phones. And now they're recording police brutality and dehumanizing homeless people. So there's struggles, right? And what I began to realize is meeting with our mayor and all of our city officials, as they're trying to figure out those core concerns within our city, the church wasn't a part of that solution. Never once was I in a meeting where they're like, well, here's a church that's doing it, and we need to replicate their model. Or here's what they're doing to really service and provide for and list those concerns. And for me, that began to break my heart, feeling like if we really believe like the Book of Acts model, right? When they began to meet together, what was one of the byproducts? They met needs, yeah. Right? It said they cared for people. And I've been at churches, and again, I'm not trying to say this is right or wrong. This is just my personal experience. That a lot of times we'll have someone come in, and maybe they're an ex-offender. They just got out of prison. Maybe they're an addict, and they just used the night before. They've had a rough night, and they make their way into a local church. And we're really good at like loving on people in that moment. We can get them a cup of coffee. We can get them a comfortable space. But when the service wraps up and we all look at our watches and we've all got to get back to life, what do we do with that person? Mm-hmm. Right? And that's a brutal question. Most of the time what happens is we call the rescue mission. Like, hey, we got somebody here. Do you have a bed? What shelter's open? Where can I drop you off? And we've lost this ability to care for people and what they're walking through. And so the first thing is that identifying causes and concerns, because obviously Denver is a large city, and you may be in a community that doesn't have the homeless issues that Denver has, or maybe it's not the heroin or safe injection site that the city is working through, but you have to identify in your community what's the concern. And here's what brings validity to that, and I think it's so important, is when you identify what the concern is, then you can truly establish a cause. Like, if there's no homeless people in your city, don't build a facility for homeless, right? But if alcohol and there's a core of single moms that are just struggling and there's a need academically, someone was telling me about, like some of the school issues here, right? If you're in Pueblo and you know that there's a core competency of what the schools are trying to figure out, we should be in the middle of that conversation providing solutions to those problems. So if you're going to establish a cause, it needs to be based on the concern. One of my biggest platforms in Denver that God's opened up for us, when I moved there, I got to Denver on a Thursday, my first Sunday. And granted, I'm a white dude, But when I was in L.A., I was the only white guy in the gym with hundreds of guys from South Central, Watts, Compton, and doing what we did. And so when I got to my first Sunday service in Golden, it was almost like a reverse being uncomfortable. Like, I know I'm a white guy, but I'm sort of uncomfortable being around all these white people right now. And I'm looking around like, where's the diversity? And anybody got tattoos in the room, right? And I'm looking, and these two guys walk in, a white guy and a black guy. White guy's all tatted up. And so I'm like, there's my guys. And so I went over, found out this is their first Sunday being at the church as well. We talked afterward, found out the black guy was living in a homeless shelter. The white guy was in a community correctional facility, or we call a halfway house. Not familiar with that world in-depthly, marginally, but not that much. I didn't know anybody in Denver at that point in my life when we first moved there. So I started going down to the halfway house, to the community correctional facility, and I just started hanging out. I would get my ID, they would buzz me in, I would hang out with this guy named Christian, spend a few minutes, and then I would leave. But I kept coming back, I kept coming back. I got to know his case manager, who happened to be a Christian lady. She became the director of the facility. One day she asked me, like, hey, when you're here, can we just open it up and let other guys come without staff, without case managers? And I'm like, absolutely. So 12 years ago, that started as a men's group to where now there's 10 community correction facilities in Denver. We have access to all 10 of those facilities. So we say that we do prison ministry. One of our concerns was then learning the process that in the United States, and you may know this, but we have less than 5% of the world's population. But we have over 25% of the world's incarcerated population. And when you dig into those numbers, they're staggering, right? And recidivism rates in most places are 70%+, meaning someone will transition to get out. They can't find a job. They can't find affordable housing, especially in Denver right now, right? People with, like, good-paying jobs. They're saying you need to be, like, at a six-figure level to afford affordable housing in Denver. It's crazy. So if you get out and you've got three felonies and you've been down for 20 years, how do you piece your life back together? And the way it works, if you're coming from Department of Corrections, when you leave DOC, they close the door. They're like, hey, good luck, just don't screw up. And you have no relationship with DOC anymore. Now you may be in community corrections or you may go to parole, probation, and everything is just so discombobulated. There is no clear path for these guys. And so as we begin to familiarize ourselves with that process, for me, that became one of my concerns. Like, there has to be something done. In Denver, it's a serious issue. In the state of Colorado, we have almost 900 people a month will parole. Of the 900, about 300 of them will end up homeless within 4 to 6 weeks. It's a major, major traumatic issue. Department of Justice will tell you that 75% of kids that have one parent incarcerated will go to jail or prison themselves. So there's this massive cycle within the system. We have almost 22,000 people that are incarcerated in the state of Colorado. I met with our city safety director last week, and he told me in the first quarter in Denver, they've made 10,000 arrests. 10,000. And so now is the next step. Like, where do we send them? Where do they go? What does it look like? And so for us, we've just got planted in that. And here's what it looks like. When you find your concern, the cause is what God begins to work within you, right? Some of you know the bandwidth of what your church can do. You may have somebody in there, or maybe it's you personally. You have an experience, a relative, a friend, and God just stirs in you like, this is my concern. And everything we've learned, it's a starting point, right? It's don't despise the day of what? Small beginnings. Yes. And you can look and hear crazy numbers. Like, I love telling people that we served over 30,000 people in the city last year. But it started with our very first adopt-a-block. We had 12 volunteers, and we served like 18. And from there, it's grown every year. So when we started doing what we call Thrive, our reentry ministry now, 8 years ago, I proposed to one of the facilities to see if we could do a Father's Day event. Having kids, it means the world to me to be with my boys on Father's Day. I have a phenomenal dad. I love being able to celebrate him on Father's Day. So I talked to one of the facilities and just asked, can we just do a barbecue? Can we get some guys out and invite their families and kids? And they're like, we've never done it, but let's try. So we talked them into it. We went to City Park. We had 7 inmates come out of community corrections, and they invited their families and kids. And if you want to talk about a powerful moment, one of our guys, Javier, went to prison, a gang member, vehicular manslaughter, some other charges. His daughter was 2 when he got arrested. He just had completed a 10-year sentence. So he hadn't seen his daughter in 10 years. Age 2, now she's 12. So we go to the park, and he's like pacing back and forth, right? As nervous as can be, because there's no guarantee that his kids are going to show up, right? It's dependent upon the mama or the guardian, whoever's got them. And lo and behold, his daughter makes it. And what I love is in that moment, what we began to realize is instead of her seeing her dad in a facility or behind bars, she sees him in a park. And immediately that wall is broke down. He becomes dad. I mean, he gets her hand and does not let go the entire time. And then we got zoo passes. We took him to the zoo. But I walked back from that moment and immediately I got gang members and guys coming over like, Pastor B, like, I got you. Whatever you need. Like, I could tell, like, right, as no matter what their past or history was, their dads, their husbands, they don't want to be in prison. They recognize that they've sacrificed years and years of their life. And so that event for us has grown. And if you want to experience what it's like, June 16th is Father's Day Sunday. On that Saturday, June 15th, we do our barbecue. Now 8 years into it, the city gives us one of the biggest parks right by Coors Field. They pay for everything. The mayor comes and speaks. We have the police chief there, which is ironic because here's the guy that sort of technically is in charge of arresting most of these guys. And we have our city safety director, a bunch of Bronco players come and just throw footballs around. This year the Denver Nuggets are on board, so they're going to come out and just facilitate giving away free stuff. We have restaurants that donate the food. Little Man Ice Cream is like our hippest, coolest ice cream place in Denver, if you've ever been there. They donate enough ice cream, so we now have over 500 people show up.
Wow.
We'll have 120 inmates that we get out for the day. And we have families that fly in from across the country because they haven't seen their husband or their dad in over a decade, some of them. But it started with that first moment of that was a concern. And if we're going to establish our cause, it's got to be on a concern that we can identify, wrap around, feel like, God, this is where you've placed us. So we also talk about Adopt-A-Block. And this, if you've been familiar with the Dream Center, any capacity. And what I love about Adopt-A-Block, it's your own version of what you created to be. Right? You can look at different models, but every city, every community has their own needs and impact. Right? Again, since church went and we're talking about that, I do that. When I go into a new city, I'll drive around. I want to know, like, what's in your backyard, what's around, and of course, like, across the street. Right? There's an Adopt-A-Block neighborhood. But Adopt-A-Block, if you are familiar with the story, when Matthew Barnett started the LA Dream Center, like a lot of us, it was this crazy passion, right? How many people can we serve and how many places can we go? And they spread themselves all over the city, cleaning up graffiti, picking up trash. And when they met back after about a year of doing that, they could look at a map and say, like, we've serviced this huge area. But if you go back into the area, nothing had changed. And again, that's sometimes the struggle we have doing outreach or local outreach and serving our community is we either just do it too infrequent or we do it too scattered and there's no return on that investment. There's no change. And in their conversation 25 years ago, that's what they're talking about. They said it's almost like we need to go in and adopt the block. And like, you know what? That's what we're going to call it. We're going to call it Adopt the Block. We're going to stay and outlast. And they use the word influence, which for us, so cause and concern. The next two words I'd give you are impact and influence. And this has become really guardrails for us that we want to have impact. We want to see a neighborhood get cleaned up. We want to see people come to Christ. In the last about 14 months, we've had just over 700 people make a decision for Jesus through the Denver Dream Center. Phenomenal response to the gospel through what we do and where we serve and the programs that we provide. And so we track impact like crazy. I think Jen there? She's not talking to somebody. I think they told me yesterday that so far we've given out over 5,000 items through our dream closet. And it's, you know, it's clothes, it's food, it's work boots, it's bus passes, it's beds, it's furniture. One of our single moms just had her sixth kid in the housing projects, and she had a love seat that was about 4 feet wide that she got off the street. So Adopt-A-Block on Saturday, we had someone bring down almost a brand new sectional. We got rid of that, and now she has a space for her and her six kids to actually sit and watch TV. So we over 5,000. So we track the impact like crazy. But on the other side of impact, and this is my heart like crazy, is influence. And I really believe that if we hold true that the gospel is the answer, that Jesus is transformational, and our cities and communities need that, that we as spiritual leaders should have influence. And I tell people all the time, it's very weird for me to step back sometimes. I feel like I need a GoPro in my head so that you can understand what my life is like. Even in the last week, I mean, it's getting personal phone calls and text messages from our mayor. Like people tell you, like, when they meet Mayor Hancock, again, agree or disagree with some of his stuff, people meet him like, oh, Mayor Hancock is very professional, and then he'll see me. And what's funny, if you ever go to Denver, and you're like, God, we had this guy do a session. He talked way too fast, drank way too much coffee. And you say his name's Brian Cedarwall. They'd be like, who's that? But if you say Pastor B, like, oh, Pastor B's my boy. Like, it's almost like living this really weird life right now. But nobody knows my name's Brian, but everybody knows Pastor B, and it's just crazy. When we got rolling within the community correctional facility, everybody I would meet in the city, I'd be like, hey, they call me Pastor B, here's my cell number. If you need something, just give me a call. Now we've realized that over 10,000 inmates have my cell number. Wow. Yeah. I don't recommend that. That just happened. And literally my phone goes off. It's on silent right now, but it goes off about every 30 seconds to 5 minutes. And it's somebody. And we do our best to respond and answer that. But the influence is what we've prayed and positioned ourselves. Again, I feel like we should have a seat at the table. If there's a discussion going on in the city of Denver, I want the church to be part of that conversation. I want to figure out how we mobilize, right? The faith community is the largest volunteer base in the world. It includes the Red Cross and Salvation Army, but we know how to mobilize people, right? How we preach on Sundays. A bunch of you, right? Which means you directly in front of you have this ability to mobilize and influence people on how they're going to serve and give back into our communities. And if we can mobilize that in the right way, then it creates influence. So yesterday I had lunch. One of my, again, another great friend is the owner of the Colorado Rockies. If you're familiar, obviously, with the Rockies, Dick and Charlie Monfort are the brothers that own that. Charlie was the original brother that got the franchise started in the early 90s. He's had a lifetime struggle with alcohol, and he and I got to be really good friends 5 years ago because his youngest twins are the same age as my oldest, and so I coached him in basketball, and God just set the stage to where now he's actually our largest donor. He gives us the most money every year in support of what we do. Our biggest outreach event last year we actually did at Coors Field, and he used their space. And that was, again, it's that idea of influence. And so our city safety director, if you're familiar with the makeup of government, our city safety director in Denver oversees between 4,000 to 5,000 employees. He's the police chief, the fire chief, 911, community corrections. That's their boss. So he works directly with the mayor, oversees everything for the city that involves safety. He's got a $600 million budget. So they wake up, and they're trying to figure out, like, how do we utilize the budget, where do we put it, and who's involved in this. Grace of God, he's a strong Christian guy. And so one of our biggest supporters. He had me come in last week and talk with our director of community corrections, his deputy director of safety, and then he pulled me aside afterward, and you can pray for us tomorrow. We've got a meeting about a building in Denver that we're looking at. But the building is out of code. And there's a lot of issues with it, and I don't even know if we'll go that direction, but he pulled me aside. He's like, I just called the fire chief, and if you need any work done, whatever needs to be brought up to code, he's like, the city will pay for it, we'll send our engineers, and the fire chief's all over it. Yeah. And so we've got the city safety director, the mayor, our police chief. I took him to a Nuggets game. Like, I'm with our police chief, I don't know, once or twice a month, and we'll just grab lunch, we'll hang out. He comes to all of our events. We just did another event 2 weeks ago. You can follow us on social media. We like to do sort of wild and crazy. And working with our inmates, some of these guys are the most creative men that you'll ever be around. And so funding is always an issue. So we put together an art show. And we, for the last 2 months, have had these guys doing art projects that were incredible. We had almost 50 art projects completed. And then we went to a private car garage, Ed McVaney, who is a billionaire. If you know his story, it's crazy. But he's got this private car showroom. And he's got 52 cars that are worth millions and millions of dollars. It's insane. So I'm like, why would we not want to bring a bunch of inmates into a millions of dollars worth of car, right? And let's just make that a happy place. And we did it. And it was crazy. And but the police chief shows up and the safety director. And just so we try to have this point of impact to where when our city is now asking, like, hey, there's a concern. Like, what are we doing with that? They now call us. And it's crazy because I tell people, I feel like I'm the junior high kid at the table, right? Like, I put on pants for everybody today, but normally, like, I'm in a hoodie, shorts, and I'm ready to play basketball, and that's my dress-up attire. My wife always yells at me when I leave the house. She's like, you're seriously going to meet the mayor and his staff wearing that? I'm like, absolutely. This is what they get. And so we talk about impact and influence. And we can step aside and say that every component, every core of our city that is looking for solutions and answers now recognizes who the Dream Center is. And again, it's taken 12 years to get there. It didn't happen because we showed up and said, hey, we're going to come and do a service project. We just came and said, how can we serve? And we kept coming back and coming back and coming back. And our city will call us last December. We're doing a project, and one of the resource officers in the city called us and asked us if we would help them because they had a senior citizen that went through an incredibly traumatic story, but her two sons were living with her. She's in her 70s. Her sons were in their 40s, and one of them actually, they got into an altercation. One of the sons killed the other son. And his wife was going through this horrible story, but her house was like the show Hoarders, inside and outside. And they said that she's got so many eviction notices now because of her yard that we are going to have to arrest her and remove her from her property. They're like, can you guys help? And we always say yes. We say yes, and then we figure it out. Our staff knows that. Like, when I come at them, they don't blink. They're just, all right, we're going to figure this out. And it wasn't complicated. We sent over volunteers. The city brought out two rollaway dumpsters. We filled every nook and cranny. Horrendous. But long story short, a month later, they called us to thank us that she now gets to age in place because her house got cleaned up. Simple moments that the city will call and serve. We get a call a couple years ago, the city attorney's office wanted to do some kind of outreach during the holidays. And we're talking the city attorney's office. There's 125 attorneys and paralegals that work for the city. Their job is to enforce, right, the letter of the law within our city. And you would think with their budget and connections, like identifying a way to serve should be simple. But the mayor said, hey, call the Dream Center, and I want you to do it with Pastor B. So they call us, and we bring over 600 presents to their office. They take two-hour lunch, and all the city attorneys and paralegals come, and they rep all the presents for us. Wow. Mayor shows up. He gives a speech to all of the – and here's the irony. Right when we're in there, we're rolling through all this, and we're like, here's what we need you to do, like write like the age specific of the present, and then boy or girl, so we know like where we can channel it. And there's some of the attorneys that look at us like, well, we have to be, you know, gender neutral, so we can't write boy or girl, like we can't give you that present, right? But that's right, we don't not serve with them because there's a disagreement on if we can label a present. We create an opportunity, and then people have a conversation, and it gives us this ability to have impact and influence to where you heard the numbers. Last year we mobilized over 7,000 volunteers. I mean, that's churches, it's youth groups, but it's like Keller Williams. We'll do a work day, send all of the real estate employees over to us. It's North Star Commercial Properties, the biggest property management company in the country now. We'll do their community barbecues through us. It's the Rockies and Nuggets and these teams that come. It's what we were able to pull off again for Christmas. Jen, wave everybody. This is our program director. I was actually Jen's youth pastor in California. And somehow she didn't run, but she stayed connected and had her own crazy journey to be part of the Dream Center. But we were meeting last year with Denver Housing, and every year we've added more layers. And we want to know, like, where's the gaps and who's not being served? And they're like, we really want to create something for Section 8. So we're like, let's do it. Long story short, we told them, invite every family in Section 8 in Denver. It's a lot of families. By the time we hit our cap, we had over 1,700 families sign up. That was over 4,000 kids. And that was the moment that we got Coors Field. The city got so on board that Parks and Rec rented five beautiful brand new charter buses. They were running 200 families an hour from the housing projects to Coors Field. They would drop them off. Then the fire department jumped in. They brought all the fire trucks and the fire chief there. The mayor and the police chief were hanging out. Macy's ended up giving us 1,000 brand new coats. We rented tents. And I don't know if you've ever rented a very large tent before. I've never. To get a tent that can handle thousands of people, our biggest tent was 10,000 square feet. It was $40,000. Wow. I'm like, they can pay for a lot of resources. They can hire a staff, or do I have a tent for a day? But we needed the space, so we just rented it, and we're like, all right, God, you got to work this out. And on that day, by the time we got done, over 8,000 people came through our outreach event at Coors Field, and we gave away $350,000 worth of resources. And it wasn't because we looked at our budget and said, all right, we can afford this. This makes sense. We have the staff. We looked at the need, and we said, all right, we serve a crazy big God. And if we position ourselves in the right place, we can make this happen. Impact and influence. Really, the last one that we really challenge people is purpose and value. That when you get into your city or your community and you begin to serve, purpose and value. One is it creates it for volunteers, right? We've probably all have been a place where you go down to volunteer and you feel like you picked up trash, you did something, but was there really any value in your time? And if you don't feel like there's value in your time, you're probably not going to come back and do it again. And the same thing with, like, what's the purpose behind it? If you go pick up trash and you come back to the same neighborhood and it looks the same, like, again, what's the value, what's the purpose behind that? And so we want to create moments that if you come serve with us, You'll see neighborhoods where we know and have extended relationships. It's created, again, impact and influence with our city, all based around our cause and our concern, and we want to identify that. But on the flip side, it's also knowing those that we serve with and serve for. These men getting out of prison, their stories are crazy. And we've got so many guys that when they were on the streets, they were running gangs, they were high-level shot callers, they always had a wad of cash, right? I mean, they could go out and they could get a kilo of coke on consignment, they could make thousands of dollars a day, they could hustle and do what they needed to do, but yet when they got, you know, onto the legal side and they go to get their first real job, these guys are getting turned down to where one of the guys on staff, now we call him Big Mark, I met him 9 years ago, Mark, when he was 17, was a gangbanger, a drug dealer in Denver. An altercation went bad. He ended up actually shooting and killing one of the guys. And so at age 17, he was convicted to life in prison for first-degree murder. And one of the first minors in the state of Colorado that was...